This episode of Generally Famous discusses suicide. If you or anyone you know needs help with their mental health, a range of organisations are available. They include the 1737 service, which offers free access to a trained counsellor, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Just call or text 1737.
Kia ora Aotearoa and welcome to Generally Famous Stuff Podcast. I'm Simon Bridges and every week I talk to a generally famous but always interesting guest about life, love and what makes them tick. Today, the boy from Te Awamutu who's done good in the kitchen, celebrity chef and restaurateur, Ben Bailey. Welcome.
Thank you.
That's right, isn't it? Te Awamutu?
That's it. That beautiful part of New Zealand.
Yeah, I was born in Te Awamutu.
Yeah, you're not.
I didn't intend to do that actually, but that's what I think of. And that would have, I think I read somewhere about you, you know, you weren't emotionally scarred growing up there. You it was cows and surfing.
Well, pretty much, yeah. We we spent a lot of time in Wongamata and Raglan, so definitely got the surfing in. But it's an interesting part of New Zealand. It's I mean, it's beautiful and I loved it, but at the same time, when I finished Te Awamutu College, I couldn't wait to get out of there. That was a big part of it.
But just, small.
Yeah, small, and I've been back down a lot recently, and again, I love the Waikato, and but it's doing what I do now. I could never open a restaurant in the Waikato.
Do you know what though? That said, I bet it'd go really well. I bet you'd make some dollars. There's some dollars in the Waikato.
Yeah, there is, but it's just sleepy. So, you know, you sort of, if you want to have a restaurant at a certain level, you often alienate a lot of the population. So you sort of, you know, you need to have a population that really understands like what dining is, if that makes sense. And it's no shade on the Waikato. You know, people are in bed pretty early. Like you walk down the main street of Hamilton.
Well, Tauranga too.
Tauranga.
Where I've spent 20 years.
Yeah.
It's a great place, great for the outdoors. But I tell you what, go for a walk at 8:45 p.m. And there's no lights on.
I know. It's crazy.
And there's no restaurants. It's got better though. Both of them.
Yeah.
I just want to defend them briefly because I can feel emails coming from, I know I've got mates in both areas that read them. When I first lived in Tauranga in sort of early 2000s at the Mount, and you'd walk down Mount Maunganui Road, you could fire a machine gun down there in the middle of the year, right? Like in about this time of year, there was no one. But it is better than that now. And there are some great dining establishments in both places.
Yeah, the Mount's pretty cool, that main strip. I think, you know, that sort of pumps a little bit. But, you know, like, I mean, even Auckland's pretty small, like on the world stage for restaurants. But you need to be serving customers sort of from 5 o'clock right through till 10 o'clock really to make it work. And so it's no shade. It's just like a financial reason.
It doesn't have the scale probably. Yep. And I'm going to do one shout. None of this was thought, but you know, I've got friends, Noel and Kim, who have, they've got the Clarence, they've got a great Italian one at the Mount. Actually, they've got one in Cambridge.
Who's Alpino,
They did a great job.
Yeah, Shadot.
So really good. I was going to ask you if you'd been back to Te Awamutu recently. And I suspect I know your answer now, but any good restaurants? And if not, would you never open one is what I think I've established.
Yeah, I never would. No, there's Red Kitchen's really good. The Readout's good for a beer. You know, Alpino in Cambridge I've been to. You know, there's some good little joints.
You could call it like the Te Awamutu Taniwha.
Could do.
Tahi and Te Awamutu, I'd thought about. Your food experience growing up, what was, did mum do a good roast or what was she?
100%. Your mum was really adventurous actually. She would, go, you know, crab fishing off the Wongamata Wharf. Amazing. And she'd cook crabs, which was, you know, paddle crab, which was kind of unheard of. She'd eat sardines, sprats, would catch sprats and she'd eat them, which was just normally cat food. She'd do stuff like pineapple chicken, which I loved. You know, Dad's the king of the wiener schnitzel with cauliflower cheese, which every time I go to Dad's, I'm like, man, can you make that?
I love a wiener schnitzel. It was fantastic.
Yeah, so there were those
pork
sort of
beef.
Always
does that have
beef.
To be, right.
You know, classically, it's veal, but you know.
Yes.
But
and I saw your show on that. We don't actually have enough veal in New Zealand, given all the cows and the bobby calves.
Oh, well, a lot of them go to pet food, right? The bobby calves. And, well, there's not a lot of bobby calves anyway because of, you know, the artificial insemination of,
right.
of you know, that I think they're pretty good at making sure that a lot of female, you know, animals are born. But, you know, it still is, in my opinion, a missed opportunity. And, yes. I mean, that episode on season two of Food Story, you know, Alan there is really just, you know, excuse the pun, taking the bull by the horns and raising these young male animals. And, you know, the meat is beautiful.
Oh, it's wonderful.
And it gives them a bit of life.
Masala.
Oh, yeah. Blanquette de Veau.
And by, and speaking of all of this, I'm sorry to go back, but I'm salivating at the. I tell you what, I'd go for at Ahi is some sardines on toast.
Yes,
done well, that would be bloody terrific. I haven't had that since a child.
I know. Well, do you know? Have you ever seen that brand, the Salty Dog? You know, bait that you buy in the service station.
Yes, yes.
That guy apparently goes out. He's an old fella, and he goes out in Whangarei every now and again, and you know, the problem is he just doesn't go out that often, and you'll catch a whole lot of sardines. And then the really good ones, he'll snap freeze, and that's what we buy. And then the ones, the rest of them go to bait. So again, like a missed opportunity, you've got this beautiful product that often in New Zealand is just not seen as a premium ingredient. Where you go anywhere in the Mediterranean, the sardines are just, you know,
well, they're
fabulous.
Fish, and they're fish, you know, I mean, not, I've done a whole lot of this. I need to do a lot more of it. But, you know, in the Mediterranean, they get these fish, they're little piddlers.
I know.
They're the undersized in New Zealand. They go out to the Sea of Galilee or wherever it is they are. And then their fish are about sort of, you know, a handful of centimetres as opposed to the big boys and girls. We sort of, what would you do with a sardine if you had that at Ahi?
Well, I think, you know, filleting it and just really kiss it on the char grill. Over the fire, really, really hot. So sort of one side gets seared and the other side is still raw. Mm. I think one of the yummiest things, I've just crumbled feta over it, a bit of pine nuts and some maybe some raisins that have been soaked in some sort of wine and, you know, make a little dressing out of that. I think that sort of thing's quite nice. So you've got a bit of sweet and a little bit of lemon juice on there, a bit of lemon zest.
Oh,
you know?
I love it.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Very good for you too.
Oh, so good for you. I'd look almost as muscly as you do, Ben. If we, I just saying to Ben earlier off the air that, you know, but I think it's the new way. You know, I grew up, I can remember my father saying, never trust a skinny chef. And you, you know, you looking good. I mean, it's the same before. I mean, Josh Emmett, some of these other guys, he's a rake.
I know.
You guys need to dip your finger in the pudding bowl more.
I know. I think Josh runs marathons. I work out every morning. I've just learnt that.
You probably have to, do you?
Oh, it's seriously. Just I got to. Got to blow the ADHD off somehow. And and I think I'm just more level throughout the day and I'm happier. And I think, you know, when you're really busy, you get so busy that you don't look after yourself and you're like, what am I doing all this for? If I don't have the time to invest in myself, like if I don't have the time to give myself 1 hour every morning, then you've got a problem, I think. And so I've got an amazing boxing trainer in Tatarangi. So I do a box, and then I've got a underhouse boxing, amazing dude. And then, you know, I've got an amazing trainer called Phil Kingy, and he, you know, sorts out all those, you know, you get to mid-40s and you from playing rugby when you're younger and you end up with all these bloody injuries that you've never really dealt with. And so it's less...
That's my excuse, Ben.
Yeah, well, there you go. But it's sort of less about, like, becoming muscly. It's more or, you know, it's just a mental thing. And then... I'm big on the longevity physically because, you know, in your 40s now, I think you really need to look after your body because I want to be a, you know, good granddad and I want to be an active person when I'm older. And
totally.
Because you work hard and you might put some money in the bank, but you might not have the health to enjoy it later
down
the track.
And I think someone was saying to me, weights and the like, they are, that's basically what they're about, right? They'll keep you living longer. They're the best antidote to that. So anyway, well, we've established amongst many other things and how we do sardines, and that sounds delicious, that you weren't scarred from growing up and in the cooking, and you probably got a bit of a sort of a sense of pedigree from that and what happened then that you take forward.
Yeah, I think so. I had an amazing economics teacher at Taumaru High School, and Mr. Hockley, and he was, I was like fifth form, and he was sort of saying, you know, what do you want to do with your life? And I said, I really like cooking. I wouldn't mind being a chef. And this guy was an amazing teacher. You know, he rang up the local restaurant and got me a job, or he got me a stage, like an internship at a restaurant in Te Amuru. It's gone now, but it was called Taylor's Restaurant. And he goes, right, if you want to be a chef, he didn't tell me, he asked me. He just said, I've rung the restaurant and the chef has agreed to take you on for 1 week in the holidays for free, and you're going to go work for free.
Amazing.
And so I went off and did that and loved it. And they gave me a job washing dishes. And so mum and dad didn't have a lot of money. So if you wanted the Billabong t-shirt or whatever, I had to go and do it. And so I got $8 an hour washing dishes, and I washed dishes on Thursday night after rugby practice. And then I'd fall asleep in class on Fridays. And then I'd play rugby on Saturday morning, and then I'd wash dishes till late on Saturday night. And it was sort of like the best introduction to kitchens because, you know, hygiene is so important. You know, like a good chef should spend, 30% of his day cleaning, really. I mean, if you're not hygienic, you know, you're going to make people sick, essentially. So, the food won't last as long and all that sort of stuff. And you learn how to work, you learn how to work fast. The chefs loved me because I just like got stuck in and smashed out these dishes, and all the buffet stuff would come back and they'd go on a break, and I'd see all these dishes. It had two dishwashing areas, one for all the pots and pans and trays, and then another area for all the plates and cutlery. And they'd go on a break in the afternoon, and it was sort of like, I was like, right, I'm in the kitchen by myself. When they get back, all these dishes are going to get done. And so I'd smash the pots, and then I'd go over there and then do the plates and the cutlery, and then they'd be coming back from their afternoon break, and I'd just be mopping the floors. And it was sort of like a bit of a game, you know, like I had to get that done, and it installed like a really good work ethic in me as well.
I think it's better to start at the back and move your way forward than go try and get to the front and be told to go to the back. So
I know, now dishwashers or we call them KPs, kitchen porters, when they start at the restaurants, they're some of my most favourite people.
Yep.
And a lot of chefs these days have never done their time in the plonge. The plonge is the dishwashing sink in French. Plonger means to dive. So they get called divers because they're in the sink all day.
Yeah.
And there's sometimes a lack of respect for that position.
Yeah.
And the people doing those jobs are just the most wonderful people. And I always say that they're the most important person in the restaurant. If these guys didn't show up, the work would be in the shit.
What sort of food was this, the Taylor's restaurant serving?
Oh, you know, it was, they did the big buffets, a lot of weddings, all those, ham on the bone buffets and all that sort of stuff. And they had the shrimp cocktails and all those sort of things
wonderful.
That you love.
No, nothing wrong with that. And then you were, if we cast forward a bit, you're a chef in the Waikato. Have I got that right?
So I went to Waikato Polytech.
Yep.
Did a full-time first year course there. And then I was like, I got another job in Hamilton at Restitia, a really good restaurant there at the time. And just started working with I had some really good advice at a young age, and that was sort of from a good chef. And he said to me, wherever you're around the world or whatever city you're in, just try to find out the best restaurant in the area and go work for them. And he said, do that till you're 30 and then become a head chef.
Yes.
And so I got that advice
That's good advice.
At 18. And so I went around basically from city to city working in the best restaurant available. And that was sort of that secret that I learnt.
I think there's nothing like in those 20s getting good, I don't like this word, but it's sort of the accurate one, mentoring, right?
100%.
Even just seeing, even if they're not very good mentors, what the best are doing. It's true in law, it's true in a bunch of other things as well. And so, on that, you're in France, Italy and the UK, and you're at Michelin star restaurants?
Yes, pretty much, most of the time.
What were some of the names of those?
So I went to Auckland first. I worked at a place called Essence, and that had won Restaurant of the Year. There was a very good chef called Martin Heiling was the head chef, and then Michael James was the Kiwi chef who owned it. And from there I went to work. I got an opportunity to work at the Sydney Olympics. So I didn't really have a lot of money, so I got paid a shit ton of money to go to the Sydney Olympics for a couple of weeks. And they paid for my flight over, and I just never came home. So I'd flown down to Melbourne, and I worked with he's super famous now, is George Kalambaras and Gary Megan off MasterChef Australia. Mm. Right before that, I'd won a scholarship I'd won a cooking competition.
US, was it?
Yeah. Yeah, so it was my first time overseas. I'd won a Commis Chef of the Year, which is Commis Chef is like a junior chef in New Zealand, and the prize was to go to this culinary university in Providence, Rhode Island. And a lot of other, 16 young chefs from around the world had won the same competition, and we all got to hang out there. And George Kalambaras was the Australian guy that won it. So we became friends. I went home, got the opportunity to go to Sydney Olympics, and then just flew down to Melbourne and started working there. And that was a real sort of baptism of fire. It was an amazing restaurant, very busy. And it was sort of my first time in a really serious place. Mm. So 2 years in Melbourne, and then I moved to Las Vegas, of all places. So I got a job there at Bellagio. And so I was sort of, 22? And at first I was in this, the kitchen's broken up into brigades, so different areas. And so in a massive hotel, bear in mind there was 10,000 staff at Bellagio. So that was sort of more than the population of Te Aumuru. And, the staff canteen of Bellagio was called La Manja. And La Manja, cooked for all these staff that were working. There was 80 chefs working in the staff canteen. There was just an extraordinary amount of humans at Bellagio there. And I worked at first in a place called the Garmage. The Garmage in French means like the cold section. So we had sort of like 80 chefs in there as well. We would do all the food for, huge banqueting. So, General Motors would come and have their AGM at Bellagio, and there'd be like 2,000 people, breakfast, lunch and dinner for, 3 days. So we'd, do the cold part of the breakfast, like we'd plate up 2,000 fruit plates. But first you had to order the fruit, and then we had to cut the fruit, peel the fruit, cut the fruit, plate it up, rack it up. They'll be done the day before, and then there'd just be like huge cold rooms of hundreds of jack stacks full of hundreds of plates, and then that would get served in these huge banqueting areas. It's hard to really articulate how big the place is. You don't order from external suppliers. You order from like basically a massive warehouse downstairs, and you'd order up lobster and they'd be holding 3,000 lobsters in the hotel at one time.
It's an exercise in massive logistics.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Huge.
And then am I right, France?
Yeah, so from there, I had a green card pending. So I could have stayed in America forever and still be living there to this day, but I really wanted to, work in some really great restaurants, especially in Europe. And my wife now, but my girlfriend at the time, she was finishing university in New Zealand, and she had moved to London, and we're sort of having this long distance on again, off again relationship. So Cara, my wife now, and so she had moved to London. So I was like, oh, I'm waiting for my green card anyway. I'll go to London for see how it is for 6 months. And so went to London and ended up at a restaurant called The Square. It's 2 Michelin star. Phil Howard was the chef. And it was sort of like the Marines in there, like the SAS of cooking. It was...
Even a step above what you'd been doing.
Oh, miles. But it was like London was the real... Like that.
People are a bit mean. I mean, London to me is, there is some of the best dining in the world.
100%. It's definitely an epicenter. So you probably have like New York, Chicago, London, Madrid, those sort of places, correct. Paris. And and it's sort of, you have that population of tourism of wealth that really demand
correct.
That level. But when I say like SAS, you got that discipline, but they had the discipline around the standards of food that you were cooking. Like the food was just exceptional, but the discipline around behavior and about what you wore, and it was just like a bunch of pirates, really, And it's a really bizarre culture, very aggressive, super long hours. And I'm not exaggerating. You're working 16 hours a day. You're falling asleep on the tube on the way to work in the morning and you're falling asleep and miss your stop on the way home.
But it is how you get your 10,000 hours or whatever, so that you really know what you're about. You come back and run some top restaurants and get 100%. Back in New Zealand.
Yeah, and I think like if you can get through that time without the PTSD and all that sort of stuff. But and I always say to the young guys, you know, you can work 40 hours a week if you want, but if you work 60, you're going to learn so much faster. Yeah. And it is a time on task thing, cooking. And I'm not sure how, you know, the employment law works in New Zealand, but they don't like you working more than, you know. Yes. But people that work really hard, I mean, this is how you learn.
Yeah, I think so. But then, you know, I would. I think, you know, those 20s, even the early 30s, you know, they're the time to really make pay if you want to have a significant career. If you don't, that's cool, but don't complain when you're 53 and you're twiddling your bow. Hey, are those Michelin star restaurants, I mean, are they just so much better? And if so, why?
I think we've had people come to Ahi and say that, you know, a restaurant in Auckland say, oh, you know, you're a one star, you could be a two star or whatever. But, you know, I think it's a rating that's judged by, you know, the Michelin tire company. And I believe the history is that the Michelin guide was created as a tourism guide for people who were purchasing tires, and then it just morphed into this system where it was just the most recognized form of restaurant judging in the world. These days, you know, if New Zealand wanted to have Michelin stars, you know, the government would need to, or part of tourism would need to bring these guys out and pay them.
Yes.
You know,
it's a racket.
It feels like it. It's just not available in every country. And yes. I mean, Australia doesn't have it. Some countries in Asia have it and some don't. America has it, but not in all places, just in the epicenters of food. So it's really sort of like if it's recognised as a feather in the cap for a city or for a country, then it's not, you know, they won't come for no reason, you know.
I mean, I suppose I sit there and say, yeah, cool. And, you know, been to some and it's an experience, but you know, I'd kind of, you know, if I think about France, you know, maybe there's something in just being at that nice bistro and having a stew.
Oh, 100%.
As opposed to some reconstituted something with smoke and whistles and, you know, a pureed small blob that they've spent 4 hours on. Your sardine, we talked about, that wouldn't cut it, would it?
Oh yeah, could do, yeah.
Could
absolutely.
Do.
Yeah. I think as you go through like a Bib Gourmand, which is the entry-level thing, and then you go one star, two star, three star. I mean, when you're talking about, say, like a three star, they'll be looking at the size of the table you're dining on. They'll be looking at the toilet, the bathrooms, you know. They'll be looking at, you know, a show plate down and the table when you sit down. They'll be looking at the flower arrangements. They'll be looking at how the sommelier moves. And, you know, there's like so much more to the experience than just the food. But the food is obviously the most important thing, but it might be 50, 60% of the judging. And then, you know, if the chef, you know, they're very particular about giving a two-star chef three stars. If they don't want to give someone a three-star and then, you know, next year they don't retain it. So they're sort of looking at how stable the guy is. You know, that's as much as I understand. There's a really great book called The Perfectionist. And it's a book about this French chef called Bernard Loiseau, who had three Michelin stars. He had it for years.
And he gave them away, didn't he?
No, he actually was so stressed out about it, losing one, he killed himself.
Oh, terrible.
And it's a terrible story of pressure. And and it's an amazing book about understanding the difference between striving for excellence and striving for perfection, because perfection is something you never achieve.
No.
And so that's another great book for people to read, especially in the industry, who are very determined and very driven and stuff like that, because, you know, that he had such a great fear of not having his three stars. He had mental health issues as well, obviously, but, you know, it turns out that restaurant, I think, I'm not sure if it still has it now, but at the time of the book coming out, a few years on, it still had its three stars. The head chef took over and his wife. And so, yeah, it was in that book, it really lays out how the Michelin guide judge. And it was a super interesting read.
Interesting, very sad. I mean, I came across one. It was a guy who had stars, I forget the name of it, and, you know, decided to give them away because actually getting more out of sort of not being in that pressure cooker.
Yeah.
What did you came back to New Zealand, obviously. What did you learn from that period, would you say? I mean, that's a big question, but what do you kind of say you brought back from that top chefing experience?
Yeah, I think, I learned a lot when I came home because I'd sort of didn't really see myself as a Kiwi anymore. I'd been away for so long. And when you watch all your mates go off on van tour in London or go to the Munich Beer Fest and, you know, do all these crazy things. And I was just investing in myself the whole time and trying to just be a sponge and learn as much as possible. But so when you're overseas, you're working, going from country to country, from Italy and France afterwards, after the London stuff. And I was sort of looking at a couple of chefs like Rene Redzepi in Noma and in Copenhagen and, you know, Fran Adrian and in Spain. And they were really taking their own country's food to the next level. And then I sort of came home and I found myself cooking dishes or cooking food that I'd, or techniques that I'd learned over there. And I think the biggest thing was that what is New Zealand food? You know, like, you know, you come home and you start cooking French or Italian or all this sort of stuff, but you're going, well, what is our food culture? But you have to sort of go away to learn that and to wonder.
I think you do, to be objective about where we are at and what we do.
Yeah,
because
we just don't have this long history of culinary excellence. You know, it's always been about, you know, we're a country built on immigration, migration. You know, the food has really been a way for us to fuel the machine or, you know, to intensively farm to export. And that's really what our food production's been about. And now these days it's all about, you know, how do we, what is New Zealand food and what are New Zealand dishes and how do we give someone a really New Zealand experience when they come to our restaurants. And I think that was the biggest takeaway.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'd thought you might say something that, like that, because it seemed to me it is your story and what you're into, and rightly so, is, you know, that provenance, the produce, where it's from, you know, what's required of it. Coming back to Kiwi land in New Zealand, you worked at The Grove, you know, a top restaurant, and now you've got sort of five restaurants and a bar and counting. And let's sort of run through them because I think they are interesting. I mean, the flagships, of course, Ahi, and I've been there a number of times. And Ahi's, of course, Te Reo for fire cooking and fire in your bellies. And you say, you kind of just said it then, but, you know, you're answering there that question, what's New Zealand cuisine, really? And that's a big question. So, you know, what's your answer to that Ahi's providing?
I think, like, you know, I think maybe this is a question that might be answered in 50 years. I don't know.
Right.
Like, I think, you know, what is a New Zealand dish? I mean, people, you know, we fight over there. I always say we fight over the Australians for pavlova and all this sort of stuff. And I think maybe our most Kiwi dish is hangi, you know, brought by Kupe like 800,000 years ago to New Zealand.
I love hangi.
It's a phenomenal, it's like, it's when you actually break it down, it's a phenomenal method of cookery, actually. And
a lot of work, though.
It's a lot of work, but
at a level.
But you think Māori, there was no Iron Age here. There's no way of, there's no pots and pans. There's, you know, it's a great way to feed a lot of people. So it may take a long time to do, but it's almost like a spiritual process when you do it. And it just gives you such grounding. And so I guess, like, a lot of it comes down to, I think what I sort of discovered on the show, the New Zealand food story, the show was actually born out of like, well, how can I open a New Zealand restaurant? How can I understand what our food culture is better if I'm stuck in the kitchen? So we had this idea.
Sweating your bollocks off in the kitchen, I think you
said. Yeah, I did say that. And it's true, you know, opening packets of lamb rack that have been vac packed. You don't know anything about how the lamb's been looked after. So to get out there and do that was just a fabulous opportunity. And then being able to actually film it too was brilliant because, you know, I'm not very good at writing down stuff or, you know, having a diary and all that sort of stuff. I mean, I write ideas for dishes down and stuff, but actually to film it is like a really great archive if you just go back. And it's also a great way to train our bloody staff, you know, because they go, look, go watch season one and rah, rah. And so it's going out there and I sort of came back and, you know, I guess after season one, I was sort of like, okay, it's New Zealand cuisine is It's about the people and it's about the ingredients. And then you're going off to meet these people and they've their journey they have undertaken to produce this truffle or, I don't know, this banana or, you know, all these, some beautiful pork or their journey has been amazing. And they've taken a similar journey to me, but just on a different parallel. And I ended up catching up with these people and realizing they're just like me, except for they raise pigs or, and there was such a connection there. And then talking to them about their animal or, you know, out in the ocean and spearing a butterfish and all these things and all the white bait at Awarua. And it becomes more about this person than it does and how their journey they took to get there as much as it does about the ingredient itself. And so when you combine an experience of staying with someone and, you know, having a glass of wine with someone and going out and fishing with them and you just have such a deep understanding. And then the creative process behind that to come up with a dish is so
different.
so normal and holistic.
If you don't have time to read the in-depth stories or you just prefer to listen instead, the Long Read From Stuff is the podcast for you. Each week, we showcase one of our excellent pieces of journalism, telling important or entertaining stories from the world of crime, sport, history, culture, and more. You also get to hear from the journalists themselves about how they uncovered the story and how it came to life. So, for your weekly dose of long-form journalism, beautifully read, subscribe to the Long Read From Stuff wherever you get your podcasts.
There's so much to talk about, it's going to be hard, but very quickly trotting through your restaurants, you've got Origine, which is classical French, and they're in Commercial Bay as well. You've got the Grounds out in the Waitakere's. That's a bit more accessible. I could have you've got the odd burger on the menu.
Yeah, that's the Wagyu burger joint.
Chris Hipkins get a sausage roll at the Grounds?
We'll sort them out, yeah.
And Iosta and Arrowtown are collab, as we like to say these days, with Sir Michael Hill. Around Northern Italian food, briefly on that, how's Northern Italian differ from, say, Southern? I mean, they're wealthier, it's a bit colder, yep. It's more risotto and the like, is it?
It's a good question. So in the south of Italy, the basic way to say it, they'll cook with olive oil. In the north, they cook with butter. You know, the food of the north is a bit heavier. Mm. You know, it's they grow great wine everywhere in Italy, but you know they're the big boy wines there and the Barbarescos and all that sort of stuff and the Nebbiolos and so you know risotto is the actual rice is sort of grown outside Milan. So if you ever take a train out of Milan and head north into the mountains, you'll see these on the horizon, just you know, really flat area, just full of rice paddies, and so you know. You know, the south is the tomatoes and the caprese salads and all this sort of stuff, and the north is all about the cheese and the parmigiano and the cured meats and San Daniel, and so it's very different. If you look at Italy on the map, I mean, it looks kind of like New Zealand. At Aosta, part of our branding is flipping New Zealand upside down and comparing it right next to Italy, and it looks very similar. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So the North Island becomes the boot, like a bit of a high heel. So it's, and then we have this 45th parallel that sort of runs through central Otago and northern Italy. And so I actually had a bit of a year off cooking. Well, I still was cooking, but I went to Chamonix and was like, man, I'm so buggered of this cooking caper. I'm going to go and live in the mountains in France and do a bit of cooking, but focus on my other passion, skiing, you know? And so I did that for a year, but we ended up in this little town called Aosta, which is just probably the smallest province of all of Italy, and it's right in the top corner in the mountain, and it's the Aosta Valley, and it's got Cumaia ski field and Chivinia and all these amazing places. And so it's just a very, very ancient town, and I just sort of fell in love with the place, pasta and, you know, all the food there was just incredible.
I bet. I've got to go there. And you've got next to that little Aosta, you've got the Blue Door Bar also in Arrowtown. Just on that briefly, what drink would you serve me up if I was there?
You know, I'd serve you probably a homegrown-y, you know, like a Negroni made with all New Zealand ingredients,
yeah, or, amazing.
you know, a whiskey from Cadrona, you know, distillery.
Oh,
or
yes, very
like
good.
That.
Quite, yeah. So they've got a strong one there.
That, yeah. And, the, and of course, that, yeah, they do.
Too much of that to get yourself on the way.
100%. And there's obviously the wine from Central Otago is incredible as well.
You've got the Bathhouse, which of course is that everyone will know it. Lake Wakatipu right there on the shore next to the playground where your kids make you go whenever you're there. And you can get oysters, bangers and mash. The oyster and Wagyu burger I think looks pretty good. Mince on toast, I think I saw on the menu. How do you make mince on toast, Chefy?
Oh, God. I treat it like essentially like a bolognese. So I'll fry off like lots of garlic and like onions and thyme, and I'd fry that off in olive oil, and then I'd throw the mince in, and I essentially would do it like beef bourguignon, but so I'd probably throw a bit of red wine in there, and then a bit of like beef stock, and cook it out for ages. And so it wouldn't be like it's not a quick process, because when I have mince, I like to braise it. So it's sort of like, you know, miniature nuggets of braised beef versus, you know, just like a quick fry up like some people would do at home. So yeah, it's like that. There might be some chopped tomatoes in there, something like that, depending on the season. And so definitely like a low and slow, and actually like sometimes put in a casserole dish and flick it in the oven and cook it for a couple of hours in there, like 120 or real low temperature. So yeah, really deep flavored. And then like a poached egg on top is always great. So
love a poached egg. Nothing wrong with a poached egg. The simple things. I've got three general questions for you around sort of your restaurants and what's going on there. I mean, the first is, given the name of this podcast, Generally Famous, I mean, you have any standout famous people walk in? You're like, holy Hector, that's...
Oh,
what's
yeah.
What's his yep. face? And I used to watch him in the 1970s when I was growing up.
When I was this is probably a bit left field, but... you know, when I was at high school, we used to listen to a band called Tool.
Yeah.
And the lead singer, Maynard, came in to the Grove, and my head chef and I were actually going to the concert the next night. And he came in and he ordered, he actually owned a vineyard in America, and he's a real foodie, this guy, but he plays this music that's just like out the gate, like metal rock. And he came in and my head chef and I literally just like freaked out. And we had these records, his vinyl records, ready to go. Actually, when he came in, I actually sent one of them home to get him. And we had them signed. Well, actually, I had three to sign, and he goes, "I'll sign one." And obviously, they're worth a fortune if he signs it.
Yes.
And so that was cool. And I had him sign the Undertow record, which was probably my favourite record. And so, yeah, we've had those sort of Pat Benatar came in once.
Cool.
And so when she was playing...
You've just alienated about half the listenership. I know, right? Because anyone under about sort of, I don't know, a certain age won't have any clue who she is.
Yeah.
But my brother actually bought me her greatest hits CD for Christmas or something. And I think, what the frick are you buying me that for? Do you think I'm sitting there? But yeah. It's cool.
Yeah, we played that. What's that? Love is a Battlefield?
Yeah.
We played. Yeah, she loved it.
How's it go?
I know.
It's funny when you mention about, there's a lot of those metal rock American guys who do have vineyards.
I know, they're crazy.
I went to, this is a bad story because I can't remember which one it was, but is it Hart or one of them? Anyway, I've got a bottle of their red wine somewhere at home that actually the American ambassador at the time gave me, but there's a few of them.
Oh, I mean.
You know, from to how would you like that?
Yeah. I guess vineyards are funny. I mean, from what I heard a bit of an expression, how do you make a billionaire a millionaire?
Buy
a vineyard. Yeah,
totally like, right.
It's a good way. If you've got too much money, it's a good way
unless
to spend
you really
it.
Know what you're doing.
Yes. Well,
and even sort of then, no, very interesting. Look, second one around your question. How, and I don't mean, it's not a trick question, but how do you do justice to so many restaurants and bars and what I mean is, you know, you're not there every time that mince on toast does go out.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Jamie Oliver, for example, I can't remember who it was, somewhere in the UK, I've been to one of his restaurants, had a good time. But, you know, I think it ended badly in his case because actually, you know,
grew too big.
You're the guy.
Yeah.
You're the one we want sort of, if not cooking for us, at least there a bit. It's, how do you make sure you've got quality going out the door?
I think one thing as I got older, I've learned how important culture is within a business. And so, we still haven't got it right, but it's something we really think about a lot. And how do we inspire people to do a great job? And so, you know, recruitment has become obviously really important, and sort of employing on character, not on ability. And so there's a lot of stuff like that that we've worked through. A lot of the guys have been with me for a long time, and I really try to invest in them as much as I can and inspire them and try to give them as many opportunities as possible. Like, I'd never go around and say, you know, I'm cooking at Ahi every night, because, you know, my best mate is the executive chef there, Mike Shatura, Mike the Russian, his name is. And, you know, Mike and I have been working together nonstop for like, you know, 12 years.
Yeah.
And he's just a phenomenal human being. He's sort of got his own profile now. He's hilarious. He's creative. And I don't think that I'm his boss or anything. I just think that, you know, we're like work colleagues in a way. And so, and it's the same with all the restaurants, where you just build a relationship where of trust, and you step in when you need to. I mean, Ahi's still the flagship and stuff like that, but it's where I spend most of my time. But, you know, like, I think I don't like being in one place all the time, and I'm very grateful for this life I've carved out, and I get to bounce around, and variety is the spice of life, as they say, and I get to sort of visit all these places, and they all serve different food. I get to hang out with different people. I mean, we employ quite a lot of people, about 160 at the moment.
Amazing.
And so,
big business.
But it is difficult, you know. People do expect you to be there, but we're open for anyway, 7 days, lunch and dinner, so I can't be there every time anyway. So Ahi or at Origin and Commercial Bay. But you do get that a lot, and it's hard to scale yourself in a restaurant. You know, you're human beings serving human beings, and you only can do however many covers per day. It's hard to grow.
Got it. No, group. And look, I think one of the themes running through any talk with you, but, you know, that provenance, the produce, the producers locally, and of course, something very interesting about you. I'm not aware of anyone else doing this. Maybe they do, but you have organic gardens in South Auckland supplying exclusively to you. So it's organic, yeah. It's fresh.
It's a labor of love. You can see why people don't do it. That's right. For sure. Like, it's not easy being a vegetable grower, and especially organic, because, you know, you can't controlling pests like slugs when, you know, your seedlings are really small and the slugs invade, you know. And obviously with the weather patterns over the last year,
hard work.
Although it's been great to have a lot of rain, I mean, but then the weeds grow very quick too. And,
right.
And so you end up being a full-time weeder.
So why do you do it?
Well, I think we had an opportunity to take over a garden from a really good friend of mine, Tamsin, who had a garden called The Secret Garden. And she was supplying a few restaurants in Auckland, and we were her biggest supplier. And for various reasons, she decided to give it away, and she just offered it up to us. And so we leased the land off her out in Patumahaui, which is just a wonderful part of Auckland. And we have 4 acres there. And I guess the thing about having a garden is that if you've got a spare bit of land, you go, I'm going to make a really nice garden for the restaurant. So it will take you a couple of years to get the soil right. And, you know, huge amount of investment. So when we took over from Tamsin, she had done all that legwork. So I can't, like, take the credit for that, because we were producing vegetables the first day we took over, you know. So, and now, like, we're sort of 2 years in coming up, and obviously with the summer that we've had, or lack of summer, and you realise that to produce enough vegetables to even supply a couple of restaurants is really hard, and then diving into the financial side of that as well, like, and the transport costs and all this sort of stuff, it's really, really hard to see how they make money.
Hard. What are we getting each season? What are we sort of, I mean, what's going on there now? What will be going on in summer?
Yeah, so you know, right now we've got the polytunnels are full of seedlings ready to be planted out, and then we've got sort of the last of our winter veg to be harvested. So we'll be finishing up carrots, turnips, you know, baby beetroots. We've got a really amazing lettuce called Sal Toast that we're harvesting. You know, so, and then we'll be getting in the ground right now sort of stuff like all our leafy greens, tomatoes are just, the seedlings are about sort of 3 inches high. So all those sort of, you know, when you say spring veg in New Zealand, I mean, it's spring, just run over spring now, but spring veg is when you plant the spring veg. And so they're pretty much, we'll be ready at Christmas. So It's a real bugger of a thing because you actually got to plan 6 months out. Mm-hmm. You got to buy the seed. You got to first of all decide what you're going to do with it in 6 months or 8 months time, and then you got to buy the seed, and then you got to plant them out in the polytunnels and look after them, and then you got to transfer that to the garden, and then you got to somehow the composting. Oh, the good thing is that all our green waste from the restaurants now we compost at the garden. So that's been a really
so it's what the boffins would call circular, right? You're taking your potash from the wood-fired ovens. Yeah. It's going back in. The kitchen waste is going in, and it's going around.
Yes, yes. And then we grab from a really great mushroom supplier, Aura Mushrooms up in Mangawhai. We take all their medium that they grow their mushrooms in, and that fungal element to the soil is really important. And so we have this combination of potash, which is sort of like the potassium element. When you look at fertilizer NPK, the K part is potassium. And thousands of years ago, humans would burn wood in pots and use the ash to that was their fertilizer back in the day. So at Ahi, we have the fire, and I'm like, man, we're chucking all this ash out, and let's, you know, make potash from it. And it's you know, we pick twice a week, but just you say that, it sounds all like, you know, great, we'll compost everything and it's all beautiful. But man, when you're trying to like keep kitchen waste in a restaurant for a couple of days until it gets picked up, and it's quite warm in there, and you got it in buckets, and it actually, the kitchen's so warm and it's in a sealed bucket, but you can still, you know, smell it a little bit. But the fermentation and the breakdown process has started, which actually advances the composting, but you need to chuck it in your car, and you got to drive out to Putumahoe, and you know, you got, you know, compost juice in the back of your vehicle. And yes. So it's, you know,
not as glamorous as it
sounds. No. And then you're picking vegetables in the rain, and it's freezing cold. We've got a great team out there actually.
I want to ask you about foraging. As I say, I was at Ahi not too long ago, and you had a great young Kiwi chef there based in Tassie, Annalise Gregory, and she was waxing lyrical about foraging, and she's obviously doing a bit of that in Tasmania, but she let slip that you do a bit of it yourself. And I think I might be making this up, but was it the kawakawa you'd been getting in the Waitex or something?
What
are you forage for? Very fashionable at the moment, but it's obviously a real an art. You got to know what you're doing at some level.
Yes, 100%. Yeah, so kawakawa is easy, it's everywhere, and you know, you can do all sorts of that. We actually put it through our sourdough, and it's really got a beautiful medicinal flavour. You can sort of wrap butter in it and age butter and things like that. And it's obviously got a huge Māori traditions around Rongo, the traditional Māori medicine, which is really interesting. But you know, there's another little fern that we love like taking, and that's again, you've got to be careful when you go in the bush and take stuff, because you don't want to take too much. So it's and so it's sort of like tricky to harvest things, especially in the Waitex, because, you know, you just don't want to, you know, go and clean something out. Yeah. But there's a little fern called Huruhuru Whenua, which is sort of it's just amazing. It's a beautiful fern, and you just take the young little piece before it unravels. But you know, there's a lot of weeds like puha. We forage a lot of that. A lot of chickweed. Right now, it's the sorrel, the oxalis. Oxalis is so delicious. Like, it tastes like lemons, you know, and it's in everyone's gut. It's the bane of a gardener's life is oxalis. Mm. And now I have hardly any of it, because I take it to work or I give it to my chickens too. But, you know, that's a real easy one for people to pick. Nasturtium is another one. So it's sort of a mix of introduced weeds into New Zealand and a little bit of stuff in the bush.
Let's do a few quick fires. Your favourite chef that's not you here, and give me one abroad as well.
Favorite chef in New Zealand. I just, what am I going to say? I'm going to, I don't know. I really love Sid Sarawat and mm-hmm. Michael Meredith. I think they're mm-hmm. both wonderful.
You would have worked with them?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm obviously friends with them. I think there's very different cooks than me, and I really love eating their food. You know, going out for dinner is a bit of a chore when you're a chef, because, you know, you spend so much time at work. When on your days off, you don't want to go out for dinner as well. But I've always really enjoyed eating their food.
Abroad?
I think overseas. I mean, I just love Brett Graham, who's an Aussie guy, but he's in London at the Ledbury. He's phenomenal. I did work there, and it was probably the restaurant that I learnt the most. Other inspiration, like chefs that do well that are not really chefs anymore but still in the industry, like Andy Cooks, Andy Herndon. Mm. And so there's other people out there that are doing stuff outside the kitchens that really inspire me. And so I've seen what Andy Herndon's doing on his YouTube and stuff, and I'm like, wow, it's super amazing. Mm. So yeah, that probably.
Favorite restaurant here and abroad.
Favorite restaurant, let's say, I'm going to hurt someone's feelings.
Yeah, a lot of pressure on that. Or just a good one that you'd like, you'd just say, yeah.
What was the best meal I had recently? I had a really great meal at Onslow. Mm. Josh Emmett's place. And Glenn Fyle, the head chef there, is very good. So I had a brilliant meal there and real classy. We had a great time. You know, when you have a meal, it's sort of not just about the food and... yes. I know a lot of the staff there, and they really looked after me. And I was there with my wife and my brother and sister-in-law, and we just had a really brilliant night. And I think, you know, when you think about a dining experience, what I want to think about, like, is it memorable or not?
Yes.
You know what I mean? And that was just such a memorable night, and I had some really yummy food and a really good time. So that was really awesome.
And overseas, you're out. You could be anywhere in the world. Where are you going one night only?
I'd go to 11 Madison Park in New York.
Well, I think that's where Andy Cook said as well.
Did he say that?
There you go, yeah.
Oh, shit.
It must be good. What's next for you?
You know, I think I'm just going to probably consolidate for a while. We opened 3 restaurants last year. COVID has sort of been, there's always in the downtimes opportunities and to expand and stuff like that. And I think once we sort of see how this financial situation in New Zealand's, obviously, we're at the coalface of the economy in restaurants, and so, you know, we're some of the first people to suffer if times are not good, because, you know, dining out in restaurants is not essential. You know what I mean? So I think, I'm in a stage where we've expanded quite rapidly, and I'm like now just taking stock, and so I will do more stuff, but I think I just want to like dive into the places that we do have, and really now I've had a bit of bandwidth to sort of like have a God's eye view of them. I can see a lot of stuff that I need to work on and that I haven't had the time or the foresight or the insight to do when we open them. And so when I say consolidate, I just mean like, you know, go inwardly into those businesses.
Deepen.
And yeah. And I just, there's so much more to it than just the dish and just the food and trying to create experiences that people remember when they dine with us.
And if you look back, I think you're 43, if I got
yes,
that right?
Yep.
You look back and you're 63, which, you know, is not really old these days, but it's 20 years' time. Well, what would you have liked to have done?
I'd love to, our New Zealand Food Story TV show, I'd really love that to be like an institution like Country Calendar is, because when you think about it, the show we do is very dynamic. You know, we look at the ingredient and how it's been harvested, and we take it all the way through to the end. And I'd love to, you know, that New Zealand food story is just, it's in its infancy at the moment. And that's something that I'd really like to explore more, and especially diving into the different regions of New Zealand and celebrating the differences, but also celebrating the ingredients and the people that are harvesting. These guys are the unsung heroes of New Zealand. And it's not, I mean, obviously, you know, for our economy, you know, these, you know, Fonterra and all these big companies that are really important, but there's a lot of little people that are doing amazing things, and they're not trying to get the most volume out of a square acre of land. They're trying to get the best out of it.
Yes.
And that might be the best way to grow, to look after the animal, but it'd also be how to, you know, find out a way to gain the best product and also the best price for their, you know, it's important that we pay these guys properly.
Yes.
And you know, so it's less about mass producing and more about, it's more deep thinking.
Yes.
And I really, you know, I really love that about New Zealand, that innovation, that number 8 Y attitude to producing ingredients is just, and then, you know, and it focuses on lesser known, like we're talking about sardines before. I mean, everyone catches sardines for bait. They don't think about eating them, you know? And so celebrating those ingredients that, you know, we need to eat.
Well, there's a challenge for you. Next time I come in, I'm looking forward to seeing on the menu. I say, well, you know why that's there? Because we had a conversation, look, the New Zealand Food Stories. It's a great show. It's got a touch of Country Calendar to it, and if I dare say so, less in a less structured, possibly more authentic way. You know, I thought it was great. I was fascinated watching one. You know, you had the young guy. I think he was all but 22, on the hill country sheep station.
Yeah,
him and his female colleague, who was about the same age. I mean, their accent was even different from in Auckland. You know, and I just think I'd forgotten about some of that. It's amazing to see these very authentic Kiwi stories and Kiwi people doing amazing things. I've got to finish by asking you the questions we ask every guest. We call them general knowledge. If you could be somebody else for a day, who'd you be?
I would be, I don't know, I reckon Barack Obama or someone
love
like
it.
Huge.
Love it. What's the most embarrassing moment you've ever had? Think of it, or a embarrassing moment.
Oh, I think, like, I hate making mistakes, like, hate it. And I'm just not in the business of making mistakes, but, you know, there's been a couple of times where I've ran food to the wrong table. Yeah. You know, chef runs the food out and he's like, you know, the head chef or whatever, and you're going out there and you put the food down, you do this big, long explanation, and they were looking at you, nodding their heads, and then you go to walk away, they go, this is not our food.
It's like, I'm a pescatarian.
Yeah, it's like you come to work and you've forgotten to put your pants on or something. Like, it's sort of that moment. It's something silly like that, I guess.
If money was no object, what are the first three things you'd buy?
I would buy one of those Singer Porsches from America. They're amazing. I'd probably upgrade the Harley, get another Harley. Something like that, you know.
Speaking of Harley's, I love that. I think one of the best cooking or chefing shows is, what are they, those two fat dudes from the UK riding around a bike? I bloody love that one.
That's a jaunt, isn't it?
And that's sort of there. Well, you know, it's could be you in sort of season 7 of the New Zealand Food Story. Which famous actor would play you in the movie of your life?
Brad Pitt.
I can see that.
No hesitation.
Grow a goatee. I could see that. What's the strangest tradition in your family?
Well, it's not really strange. I think the manu competitions in the pool, probably.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know. 40.
You any good?
Yeah, I can definitely crack a few manus, but now you just, you know, you had a couple of beers on a Sunday and you try to do some manus in the pool. You pay for it on Monday, don't you?
Yeah, fair enough. If you could choose to stop aging at any age, which would you choose?
Definitely now, yeah.
Love it. 43, prime of life. Ben Bailey, thank you so much for coming on Generally Famous. You've been listening to Generally Famous, a Stuff podcast. There's a new episode every Wednesday. You can listen to them all at stuff.co.nz/generallyfamous or wherever you get your podcasts. In fact, if you follow us on Apple or Spotify, any of the podcast apps, in fact, you'll get the latest episodes automatically. Sounds good, right? Thanks to my producers, Chris Reed and Jen Black, and audio editor John Rupiah. I'm Simon Bridges. I really appreciate you listening.
If you like this podcast, please support our work. Visit stuff.co.nz/support.
Hey, Chris.
Yes.
Do you want another very broad question? I've got a very broad question today.
Go on then.
What do you know about sports?
Up the Wazz! Go the Black Caps. And don't forget Premier League football.
Oh, you do love a bit of Premier League footy, don't you? What team is it that you support again?
Oh, the current champions, Manchester City.
I think they're pronounced Arsenal. It's pronounced Arsenal.
But you know what's good about football?
At what?
They don't regulate soccer height.
I'm sorry? There's a sport that regulates sock height?
Indeed there is, and it's cycling.
That's very strange. Why on earth do they regulate it?
Well, I know, but if you want to find out, you'll have to listen to the Big Stuff Quiz, wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, that's a cliffhanger indeed. The Big Stuff Quiz is brought to you by Melbourne Every Bit Different.